back to Paths to Purpose. Thanks for joining us again this week. We're really excited to host Shira Mansourabe, who has a phenomenal story and she's a force to be reckoned with. Alan, could you share more about how you met Shira and how you became aware of her charity?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So I was asked to do a talk to a group of young adults about career planning and careers with impact. And apparently she was in the audience because it was a virtual talk. And during the pandemic, and then she reached out to me and wanted to discuss a little bit about the charity she was working with. And from the moment I heard about the charity, I was completely blown away. And what struck me about her was how incredibly precise her clarity of purpose was, how incredibly overwhelming the problem was that she was trying to address. And yet she pushed forward with it anyway, and was able to figure out a way forward to try to help people. And so I was like, this is somebody I need to learn from. And I wanted to hear more of her story, which is why we invited her to this today.
Yeah, I met her through LinkedIn. She reached out to us after we posted our episode with Monique Malcolm Hay. And she was so much fun to chat with and to just hear all of the work that she's done is just truly inspirational. So we're really excited to have her on today. Let's just get into it. We're really excited. So let's chat with Shira. This week, we are joined by Shira Mansourabe. Shira is a multilingual law graduate and public speaker with a proven track record in humanitarian work and experience in financial and legal advisory services. She is an enthusiastic leader, confident in taking individual responsibility and effecting change through socially responsible humanitarian initiatives. She is passionate about improving policy and legislation to tackle challenges encountered whilst delivering mental health services in Africa and Europe. Shira is the founder and CEO of I Am Somebody's Child Soldier, a UK-based charity dedicated to empowering former child soldiers and victims of war suffering from post-war trauma and financial instability through supporting sustainable livelihood initiatives, rehabilitation, psychotherapy, and raising awareness about the social stigma attached to mental illness across Africa. The charity hopes to create environments where former child soldiers and victims of war are not haunted by their past experiences. Shira was also recently appointed to the board of Amnesty International, which is incredible. Shira, welcome to Paths to Purpose, and thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really exciting to be able to share my story with your audience.
We're so excited to hear your whole story. Can we start by maybe what you're doing currently and how you got to this point?
I am currently supporting the board of I Am Somebody's Child Soldier, both as CEO, but also as a founding trustee. In terms of how I started on this journey, so I've always been passionate about supporting my local community. I'm originally from Uganda, and 7 years ago, I had the fortune of visiting Uganda to see how I can support my local community. And on that visit, I noticed there were a lot of child soldiers there were a lot of street children who were either displaced, or by interacting with the local leaders, I got to understand why they were street children. And after that trip, me and my husband, who is also a founding trustee, James Mansourabe, decided to set up a charity that supports rescued child soldiers in northern Uganda. So the common theme for me and James is that James is from Sierra Leone, and there is also a large number of former child soldiers in that country. So over the last 7 years, we've been very passionate about ensuring not only are we empowering child soldiers by giving them access to education, support mechanisms through their teachers, but also the mental health aspect and ensuring that they could get ongoing support to overcome the trauma that they endured as active participants in the war.
That's incredible. I think if I'm thinking back to where I was in my early career, hearing someone who had started their own charity would sound really intimidating, and I would have no idea where to start. So can you explain more about how you decided to start this charity and the process that you went through to get to having this NGO and getting it labeled as such and everything within the UK?
Yes, brilliant question. So in terms of how we started, I think let me take a step back. So I always knew I wanted to found a charity. It was just something that being a fundraiser, because I did some fundraising experience prior to starting university, and I fundraised for organizations like the British Red Cross, Amnesty International, and I got to interact with donors, you know, via street campaigns, where I understood the power of charities and the power that charities can have in implementing solutions. So when I had the opportunity to go to Uganda, it was more that I wanted to set up a charity. I wasn't quite sure what my beneficiary audience would be. So when we came back, based on my legal training at the time, it was a bit easier. So we could fill in the charity applications ourselves. We worked with our family members and our friends so that they could be the first donors and the first supporters. And I think most importantly, we had an event, a launch event. So as we were waiting for the Charity Commission to approve our application, we decided to put on a fundraising event where our family, friends, people who cared about this issue could donate online, but also they could contribute ideas and they could help us build it in a way that it wasn't just a solution in terms of a charity, but it actually picked up on bringing people together so that they could be part of the solution.
That's so inspiring that you took the initiative, and one, that you had that desire to do this already in some capacity, but then that you just decided to do it. Was there any moment that you had a catalyst for this change in your life to go from this very, I'd say, secure legal career path to deciding to start your own charity and to go off and, I'd say, be more risky if you're thinking about it in maybe a younger person's perspective?
Yes. Interestingly, by the time I decided to set up the charity, I had just finished law school. So I wasn't in legal practice. It was more of a pivotal moment in terms of which direction do I want to take my career. I could either pursue a commercial legal career or I could pursue a humanitarian and human rights focused legal career. And to make that decision, I had the opportunity to intern at the Council of Europe in Strasbourg. And then I also very intentionally asked to be placed at the European Court of Human Rights, just so I could see how the laws are debated, implemented. I was adamant that I wanted to go into humanitarian work, but I wanted the understanding of how do you work in this field and what's the best way forward. So internships are a very great way to unpack that as somebody starting in this field, but also just tapping into extracurricular activities. So, you know, volunteering and fundraising, those activities help frame my understanding at the time of what it would mean to work in the charity sector. And I guess based off that, I was able to make the decision confidently that I want to set up a charity and I want to be part of the solution. So, you know, the problem is grand. We have war victims, war veterans, child soldiers. It's such a big problem. But I knew the way that I could help was focusing specifically on mental health and rehabilitation. So I very intentionally narrowed my focus or the charity's focus that way. Although over the last 7 years, we've realized that there is a host of different issues when it comes to mental health and rehabilitation. And as a charity, we need to address them within our strategy. But I guess going back to your question, it's just, you know, finding a way that you could enter the sector or enter a different career by tapping into internships and volunteering opportunities.
So Shira, thanks for sharing your story today. Every time I hear it, it's incredibly remarkable and it's inspiring. I've worked with many listeners who have issues or who have interest rather in doing community work. The problem that they face is often around their own personal financial security and also the overwhelming nature of the problem. I wanted to hear your thoughts about financial security for yourself while you're pursuing a pursuit of passion. And also, you already hinted a little bit about how you broke the problem down to make it simpler. How do you deal with it being overwhelming?
Brilliant question, Alan. So yes, I'll start off with the problem. So being in the humanitarian or charity sector, there are a host of problems that we all want to work on and support. But I tapped into my passion so that I can narrow it down into mental health and rehabilitation. So that was the first step. And because I genuinely have a passion for working with, you know, individuals who've suffered from PTSD, anxiety, depression, all of these mental health challenges, it made it easier for me to narrow the charity's focus that way right from the beginning. But secondly, in terms of the financial aspect, that lends itself to both my passion for it. Therefore, in the beginning, I was not getting paid for a lot of the work that I was doing. But secondly, it meant that I had to still maintain a job elsewhere where I could have an income. And over the last 7 years, what's helped me maintain the work and the time commitment that I put to this is because I genuinely have a passion for making a difference. And I also have to be very careful how much time I put towards it versus how much time I put towards my paid job as well. So for any listeners who do have a passion and are thinking, how do I balance this with an income generating job? It's really, if you're passionate about something, you find those extra 7 or 8 hours a week to put towards it. But also it's the team around you. So I lean heavily on our board of trustees, who are all volunteers as well, and they bring different expertise to the table. And then we also have a structure in place where we bring on volunteers to support us. So if you spread the work with a good, strong team, it doesn't seem as overwhelming. Whereas I have seen in the charity sector, people who set up organizations and they're very passionate about it, but they're a one-man band and you can't run a charity like that. The governance requirements alone are quite cumbersome. So you need to spread that through a very strong team of trustees, but also a senior management team and a volunteering team. And that way, even though the problem is big, you're still chipping away at it in a very intentional and concerted way.
Thank you for saying that, because that's what I've been saying to people, is that virtually no major project happens alone. And it's all about the ability to build a collaborative team around it and to break it down into simpler bites, if you will. Is there a way to actually make money in this? I mean, do you have to separate it and do it independently and work on the side?
So to answer that question, actually reflecting on my experience, right from the beginning, I had a decision to make. Did I want to be a trustee, therefore non-paid, or did I want to be a full CEO with no representation on the board? And personally, I decided that I wanted to still retain a position on the board as a trustee. Therefore, I took on a voluntary position as a chief exec. So for others who are much more inclined to do the operational and the administrative part of running the charity, by all means, you can stay on as a paid employee. But that's also reflective of your income generation model. Most charities, especially the smaller charities, face the challenge of having to have enough money to pay yourself as a CEO, executive director, whichever position you take, but also how you're going to support your beneficiaries. And because our charity is internationally focused, we work to ensure that our beneficiaries get the most value for the money that we bring in. And at the time where we're bringing in a decent amount, not necessarily large in comparison to other charities, our intention was always to make sure we had as much money going back to our beneficiaries as possible. But moving forward with the different projects that we have in mind, we're very intentional around making sure we have an income for a paid executive member.
So you just said that you have had this passion for humanitarian work. Could we go back to how you got to that point and how you kind of arrived at finding that purpose in your life? And like, what age were you at? What circumstances helped you get to that understanding of what you wanted to do in your life and the impact that you wanted to make?
Yes. So in terms of age, I must have been, let's say, 11 years old. So I am originally from Uganda, as I mentioned, and I grew up here. But when I was around 10, 11 years old, my parents decided to take me back to Uganda. And it was at that point that I entered boarding school. And the very first evening I was in boarding school, I had the unfortunate experience of being in a class filled with very young, vibrant individuals who were not supposed to be making as much noise as they were. So the teacher walks in and he tells everyone to get down, and he was about to cane everyone. And coming from the UK, being very aware of what you can and cannot do to a child, I stood up and told the teacher, "You cannot cane me. I'm not going to allow to be caned." And this was a male, very tall teacher. So to have a sort of 10, 11-year-old standing right in front of him and telling him, "You're not going to cane me, I have refused to get down," was probably his first instance of ever having a child talk back to him like that. And, you know, for a few seconds, we were staring at each other. And I was very determined, you know, I'm not going down. And I think he read that message on my face. And he turned away and walked, and he didn't cane me or any of the other children. And right there and then, I made a decision that I have a responsibility to speak up when an injustice is unfolding in front of me. But also, if I know what's being done is wrong, that is an opportunity for me to speak up. So, you know, fast forward however many years later, I am still a passionate advocate for human rights and protecting the rights of children and ensuring that when something is unfolding in front of me, even though it's daunting, if at least I speak up and I make it very clear that I won't accept this, then that person who I'm speaking to can either take my stance and push it to the side, or they can have the clear knowledge that, you know what, this is wrong and I shouldn't be doing this. So yes, that's my story.
I can't even imagine standing up to someone being 11 years old, and regardless if it was a peer or a teacher, or especially someone who had the height difference. I think that that's when you're small and you're a child, that's something that's very hard, as people are so much taller than you, and that power dynamic yes. in and of itself is so challenging. So I think that that's just so inspiring and such a great history of why you decided to get into this work. So thank you for sharing that. The next thing we wanted to talk about, I think, was just kind of imposter syndrome and if you've dealt with it and what it feels like for you. When do those feelings arise and how do you address them?
Amazing question. I think that's something that I continue to reflect on, even where I am in terms of my accomplishments. Every time I feel like every time as an individual you accomplish a new milestone, you inadvertently put yourself in an environment where you might feel a little bit out of place. So personally, I have been in the charity sector for over the last 10 years. And every time I accomplish breakthrough in terms of funders or grants, I'm surrounded by people who are perhaps not necessarily representative of my race, ethnicity, or any of my attributes. But what has helped me overcome that is knowing that I have something to contribute to that conversation. So I'll give you an example. With the charity, I Am Somebody's Child Soldier, when we were recruiting our second set of trustees, every 3 years we recruit new trustees. So this time round, I looked for trustees that were experienced, that brought a lot of skills to the table, and that were professionals and were filling in the gaps that we had identified over the last 3 years. What that meant was that we brought in very senior individuals who were much more experienced than me and the other founding trustee, and they brought a different lens of exposure. So all of a sudden, we came from having power dynamics, as we call them, to then not necessarily knowing some of the things that we should know as founding trustees. But what that made me do was go back to do a master's, because I realized I can't be the founding sort of trustee and CEO. And there's some gaps in my knowledge in terms of mental health, human rights, development issues. So I went back and did my master's at UCL. And that equipped me so that when I was sitting on the board, I could contribute to those conversations. And moving on, I also realized I wanted to do a PhD. And that's not necessarily to contribute even more, but it's more so that I really understand the problem so that I could contribute adequately to these solutions. So to wrap it up, wherever I have faced imposter syndrome, it's been a point of reflection for me of, okay, why am I feeling uncomfortable in this space? What can I do differently so that I can equip myself so that I never feel uncomfortable in this space again? And then taking the necessary action to follow through on that. So I guess that's my piece of advice there.
Absolutely love it. I don't even know how to follow that up, to be honest. Can you speak a little bit to the impact of your organization? What have you seen as far as outcomes?
Great. So in terms of outcomes, in the first 3 years, we were successful in fundraising. We were able to raise over £500,000, and that money went back to support the children to access educational equipment. We were able to support with scholastic programs. But most importantly, we were able to help parents or the caregivers of these children access business opportunities, because we realized very quickly, in order for us to ensure stability and security for children, we needed to tap into their caregivers and their local community. So by understanding that some of the caregivers couldn't afford to keep children in school, they couldn't afford to put food on the table. Therefore, we set up microfinance opportunity and also a business training opportunity for them. It was predominantly women, funny enough, that attended these series of workshops. But through equipping them and upskilling them on how to sustain a business model, how to ensure that their small scale farming could actually bring in enough income for their household and the school fees, we were able to sort of record that as a positive outcome. because no matter what happens 3 years later, at least the families have this business literacy and the skills that they need to continue to bring in an income. And then as a charity, it gives us that sustainability power in that we're not constantly having to give out money or products or scholastic equipment if the very people who are supposed to be responsible for giving this out are equipped on how to do that. So I guess that's one of our important outcomes in the first 3 years. Moving on to the second set of 3 years, we were able to partner with Eton College here in the UK and have the children at the school where we work. The school is called Lara Ardra. So the children, they made it very clear to us that they wanted to participate in digital literacy skills and how could they communicate with the outside world. And there is a huge gap in terms of IT literacy. So we designed a pen pal initiative where we had the Etonians communicate with the children at Lara Ardra. And through the letter writing, it was a way for them to share their experiences as students, because the same age group, but different dynamics, different experiences, but also uplift them in terms of, you know, some of the questions that we'll pose were, what do you see yourself doing in the next 5 years? And the responses from the children in Uganda was, you know, I want to play football or I want to work in a bakery. So very lighthearted responses, but it just got them to think beyond their experiences as former child soldiers and really start paving a positive outlook on their future. And also for the Etonians, it was a way for them to understand that these are children who've had a very traumatic past, but they're still committed to their education, to communicating with people outside of their community, and just building that global citizenship. So yeah, I'm happy to pause there for now.
Yeah, I think that's phenomenal. I would love to ask you more about, on that note, the psychotherapy that your organization provides to these kids. And how do you support these children's, their mental health after such a traumatic experience? And how do you help them keep going in their life and get to this place where they can think about their futures? And, you know, aside from just the what you talked about with making sure that their families have the financial stability to support them through school, how do you help them get to a healthy mental state to be ready to go and learn and to think about their future?
When we set up as a charity, the first 2 years was us working with local partners to understand what's the best model to ensure that we were really capturing the needs of the beneficiaries, especially because we're an international organization. So we needed to be very careful on our partnership model to ensure our work was still impactful. So based on the feedback, we decided to partner with a local school. And the local school was called Lara Ardra. And this is predominantly where children who have either been, you know, former child soldiers or born in captivity or child-led households, this is a school where they would all attend. So by partnering with that school, we were very intentional around making sure we support very core beneficiary groups. So based off that, we decided that in order for us to support their mental health and mental well-being, we would set up a mental health teachers training program where we had experts or counselors, psychotherapists come to the school and train the teachers on how to spot instances of mental illness, how to support children who were struggling with mental illness, but also how to ensure that the whole community around the children in terms of the school community was supportive. So through that program, it was a 1 week intensive workshop. Different aspects of psychotherapy were shared. One of the most important ones was storytelling time or story circles, where children in small groups can sit down and by talking about their experiences in a hypothetical story format, it takes away the pressure of them saying, this is what happened to me. And as a result, I'm a child soldier. Because we have to remember there is a stigma associated to being a former child soldier. And there is a stigma associated to being somebody who committed atrocity to your family. But story circles, because they're hypothetical, it's more like a child is telling a story. And in that story, if you are trained, you can pick up on whether or not this is reflective of the child or whether or not this child needs more support. And if any situation does arise, we have a referral mechanism in place where children can be referred to specialist psychotherapist workers within the community.
So Shira, can you speak a little bit about the current climate and the effects it's had on your work? I'm thinking in terms of pandemic, the rise of nationalism, things like that.
Yes. So in terms of the pandemic, one unfortunate impact is that the children are not at school. So since last year, March, when the first lockdown happened, the children were sent back to school, and it's only children who are in the years that are taking exams. So only examination years are attending school. So with the remote studies and with the fact that some of these children were child-led households, so you're sending a child back to a house where they are essentially responsible for three or four other children, it makes it very hard for children to continue in education. And we've seen a report of children getting married off young because they need that stability, or because their parents or caregivers think that this is too much for me to handle three young children, let me marry the other one off. So we've seen a high rise in child marriages. We've seen a high rise in child labor in terms of children now having to support their family on the farms or the local business initiatives. And I guess for me, what the saddest impact is the high rise of mental health, because we've gone from having children who are suffering from trauma and PTSD to children who are now put back in those communities or situations that are quite unstable, but also they've lost the support mechanism of the mental health support worker at school. They've lost the camaraderie of their peers. They've lost the stability of knowing that there's a brighter future, because we all don't know when COVID or the impact of COVID is going to subside. But I think speaking on behalf of those children, there are a lot more negatives of being on the ground. And again, I don't want us to go too much into the vaccine nationalism debate, but it's quite unfortunate. But as a charity, what we decided to do late last year was to set up an initiative called the Solar Radio Program, where we could distribute radios within households so that the children who couldn't access education because they're not at school could still access it through the National Radio Education Program. And just to give a little bit of context into that program, the Ugandan government decided to have lessons all delivered via radio stations because, you know, a significant number of households have radio stations but don't necessarily have TVs or laptops. So that way children could still sort of tap in at a specific time and at a specific radio station and continue to receive some sort of education. We must admit that we were able to distribute just under 100 radios, and we do have children still engaging with it, but where there is no clear deadline or target for children returning to school, it's quite challenging to ensure that all the information the children have learned from school is recorded and examined on, and even monitor the outcomes of that program as a charity. So that's still something that we're grappling with, but we are hopeful that we'll be able to continue to support the program and the children moving forward.
I don't know how to follow that. Like Alan said, after your last answer, I think one question I have on my mind after hearing the complexities that exist in this space and in specifically regard to how COVID has impacted these kids, I'm wondering about how you take care of yourself, Shira, and your own mental health. These are big problems with real impact. And how do you take care of yourself so you can show up every day for these kids and for your charity?
So that's a question that I keep pondering on, because sometimes I have good weeks and then other times it's more that, okay, I need to take a pause. So what I tend to do, I love swimming. I try and swim at least twice a week. And I always say that's a good way for me to just press pause. Journaling and meditation as well. So I guess it's more or less the things that everyone says to do. But if the way that I found it beneficial for me is by incorporating it in a way that it doesn't interfere with my personal life, because I do have two young children as well. I have a 4-year-old son and a 6-year-old daughter. So I guess part of my mental well-being is playing with them and just spending some time interacting with them.
I wanted to run a question that we typically run when we're working with students who are trying to do self-exploration by you, if that's okay.
Yes.
And one of my favorite questions is, if you could meet with anybody for an hour and have a conversation anywhere in the world, whom would you choose and what questions would you ask?
Oh, I'd like to say Michelle Obama. Actually, it is Michelle Obama. I read her book and I could relate with so many things on different levels, but mostly around her being a mom with children, but also commitments. You know, she's very passionate about her humanitarian work and community work. So the question for me is, how do you balance being a humanitarian at heart, but also being somebody who everyone else looks up to? So yeah, that's a question for her.
Are there any resources that you've used along your journey to help you better understand yourself or the work that you're doing? So books, articles, YouTube channels, like anything that's really helped you along your path to finding your purpose and do the work that you're doing today?
Yes. So one book, which is probably more so to do with my own understanding of humanitarian work and the impact we can have in the charity sector. The book is called The Soul of Money, Reclaiming the Wealth of Your Inner Resources by Lynn Twist. And the reason why I cite that book is because it helps you understand money means different things to different people. But ultimately, when we are in the humanitarian sector, we're in the business of getting people to connect with an issue so much so that they give money to it. But if we don't understand that these individuals who might be wealthy or might have a different interpretation of money, how do we ensure that we distribute that money properly and it goes towards the right social challenges and the right way to help bring solutions that are sustainable? So yes, I cite that book. There are a few other books. I think No Limits by John C. Maxwell. That's a really interesting one. I guess when I am saying that I have children and I also run a charity and I'm also sitting on the board of Amnesty International as one of its newest trustees, everyone's always asking me, how do you do it? So this book, No Limits, is a fantastic book to read because it shows you that you are capable of doing a lot if you are passionate about it and you genuinely have a belief in you are making a difference. So yes.
You're hitting on all of our main points, Shira. We haven't even prepped any of this. We haven't.
I know. Yeah, I think
I'm so happy to hear all of these things from you because it's so inspiring. And thank you so much for coming on today and for sharing your story and being such an inspiration. I can just speak for myself. It's really amazing to see the work that you're doing and how you just went on this path. And I'm very inspired. But I wanted to also offer, if you wanted to share, where people can find you and find your work before we sign off here today.
Yes. And again, it's been incredible sharing my story with your podcast or with your audience, because I'm so engrossed in the work that I do that I don't necessarily get a chance to speak about it or to tell people my journey. So this is a remarkable opportunity for me to be able to share it. And I also hope that people get inspired. I'm very, very passionate about being the change you wish to see in the world. And I know we've heard that quote a million times over, but if everyone did take that small action and did, you know, reach out to their grassroots organizations, or it's not that everyone has to set up a charity. By all means, you don't have to set up a charity, but contact your local charity as long as you're passionate about the area they're working in and see how you can get involved. So yeah, thank you for the opportunity. In terms of where they can find us, our website, iamsomebodyschildsoldier.org, that's a really good way for people to get involved and express their interest in either volunteering or just subscribing to our mailing list. Also, LinkedIn is a good platform for people to reach me individually. I do tend to share updates on there or sending messages on there as well.
Well, thank you so much again for taking the time today. We're really happy that you had an opportunity to just come on and share your story with us. And for our listeners, we will also be sharing Shira's contact info and her website on our Instagram page. As per usual, if you have any thoughts or feedback or you want to share this episode with your friends, our Instagram is @paths2purposepod and our email is paths2purposepod@gmail.com. Thanks so much, Shira.
Thank you very much.
Bye, everyone. Thanks for listening. This episode was made possible by our audio engineer, Jack Booth, and our growth strategist, Mikey Lulo. For more resources and inspiration on finding your purpose, check out our Instagram @paths2purposepod. We'll see you next time. Bye.